So I'll start sitting on here and talking about
some work that I've been doing with Lev Weidman at Tel Aviv on the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. So the many worlds interpretation is primarily a response to the measurement problem. Roughly, the measurement problem is this. In a quantum measurement, the formalism, the Schrodinger equation and the wave function, corresponds to a superposition of all possible outcomes. But when we actually go and do a measurement, it doesn't seem like that's what we observe. It seems that what we observe is a single outcome. And so at least on the face of it, it looks like there's a problem. So over the years, many solutions have been put forward to solve this problem. So for example, there are the dynamical collapse theories, which alter the Schrodinger equation in an attempt to make sense of the idea that the wave function collapses. There's also the additional variables theory. Perhaps the most well-known version is Bohmian mechanics, where quasi-classical particles are introduced in addition to the wave function. And I think Yekir's two-state interpretation would fall under this category as well, where the backwards evolving wave function is postulated in addition to the forwards evolving wave function. Now, one of the major attractions of the many worlds interpretation is that it doesn't introduce anything. It tells us to keep the formalism as it is and don't change it. So on this view, the description of reality is given by the wave function, the dynamics is given by the Schrodinger equation. No need to change it. So that's one of the major attractions of the theory, that it, the simplicity of it. It tells us that there isn't really a measurement problem. It was a mistake to think that there was a measurement problem. There are other attractive aspects of the theory as well. It removes objective randomness from quantum theory. Arguably, it removes non-local action at a distance. And it's also experimentally testable. So while it's true that the many worlds interpretation makes predictions that are physically impossible to verify, tells us that planet Earth goes into superposition, that's not something that we can verify. What's important is that it makes a large range of bold and distinctive predictions, which can be verified. So we've seen a couple of talks already in this conference about experiments that test for failures of the Schrodinger equation at larger and larger scales as we go up to mesoscopic and macroscopic scales. And insofar as those experiments fail to find failures of the Schrodinger equation, we can take that to some extent as being confirmatory of the many worlds interpretation. And if we get to the stage where those experiments rule out the dynamical collapse theories, then I think we can say that there's strong empirical evidence for the many worlds interpretation. Okay, so you're all fairly familiar with the physics of the many worlds interpretation, since the physics of the many worlds interpretation is just unadorned quantum theory in its mathematically most simple and elegant form. So I'm going to talk to you about interpretation and ontology. To understand what this theory says about reality, that is to understand what unadorned quantum theory says about reality, I think this postulate that we have at the top here is useful. So what it says is that an object in a macroscopic superposition is to be interpreted as a multiplicity of macroscopic objects. So when the formalism corresponds to a measuring device that's in a superposition of exhibiting many different outcomes, we are to interpret that as a multiplicity of measuring devices. Each one exhibits its own single outcome. Now, before a measurement, we just presumably have one measuring device. After the measurement, we have a multiplicity of measuring devices. So the consequence is that a measurement is going to cause the measuring device to split. And the measuring device is going to, in turn, cause whatever it's entangled with to split as well. So the measuring device will be entangled with its environment, and so the environment is going to split along with it, and that's where we get the idea of many worlds. And so with that, we can see a solution, or perhaps a dissolution, to the measurement problem. Measurements only seem to have one outcome, since each outcome is observed in a different world. Okay, so arguably then, quantum theory, unadorned quantum theory, has its own interpretation. That is, it gives us an ontology, it gives us a picture of reality, and it does so in a way that removes the measurement problem. So why is it not more widely accepted? Well, I'd be very interested to hear your reasons for not accepting this theory. What I'm going to talk about is the major reason for why the many worlds interpretation is very unpopular among philosophers. So the reason for that really centers around a particular objection, which is called the probability problem. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain what the probability problem is, and then I'm going to try and solve it within a framework that I call the self-locating uncertainty approach. And then once that is done, I'm going to go back to ontology, and I'm going to try and illustrate how the two-state vector formalism plays a useful role in further clarifying the ontology of the many worlds interpretation. Okay, so the probability problem. Usually the probability problem is split up into two distinct problems. The first is the incoherence problem. How can probability make sense when all outcomes are realized? So just take a simple example of a quantum mechanical measurement that has two possible outcomes, outcome A and outcome B. So it might be a measurement of a spin half particle. In such situations, quantum mechanics typically tells us that outcome A will happen with some non-trivial probability, perhaps probability 0.9, and outcome B will happen with some non-trivial probability, perhaps 0.1. What does quantum mechanics say about such a, what does the many worlds interpretation say about such a scenario? Well, the many worlds interpretation tells us that in such a measurement, outcome A will certainly happen, and outcome B will certainly happen. And so it seems to follow from the many worlds interpretation that outcome A will happen with probability 1 and outcome B will happen with probability 1, in direct contradiction with quantum mechanics. And so when you put it like that, then the many worlds interpretation as an interpretation of quantum mechanics looks like a non-starter. So that's the incoherence problem. The quantitative problem basically says, imagine that you can find some solution to the incoherence problem. Maybe you can find some locus for uncertainty within the many worlds framework from which you can define a probability measure. Even so, why would that probability measure correspond to the correct quantum mechanical probability measure, the Born rule? So how does the many worlds interpretation explain the Born rule? Okay, so let's go straight into the solution. So the aim here is to try to establish what's been called the Born-Weidman rule. So this that phrase comes from a paper by the philosopher Paul Tappenden, dubbed because it's based on an idea that Lev Weidman put forward many years ago. So what the Born-Weidman rule says is that pre-observation descendants should assign self-locating probabilities in accord with the Born rule. Okay, so let's break this down. First, let's consider what's meant by a pre-observation descendant and then what's meant by self-locating probability. So first of all, pre-observation descendant. An experimenter, when they do a measurement, according to this theory, creates descendants, creates multiple versions of themselves. And that's just what we mean by a descendant. And the experimenter, when they do such a measurement, can decide to do the experiment but not look at the result. That's what a pre-observation descendant is. Okay, someone who's done an experiment, created a branching event, but doesn't look at the result. Now, such a pre-observation descendant is going to be uncertain as to what world they're in. And that's self-locating uncertainty. And then the idea is that we can define a probability measure from that uncertainty. Now, in the literature, this idea is sometimes illustrated in fairly abstract ways. The experimenter does a measurement, splits into several descendants, but takes a sleeping pill before looking at the result, gets sent off into a faraway room, eventually wakes up, and then asks, what is the probability that such and such a result occurred? Or, in other words, what is the probability that you're in a world in which such and such a result occurred? But I think there's fairly concrete ways of understanding this. So, for example, imagine you're a physics professor, and you have a grad student, and you want that student to go run some experiments. So you tell them to go run some experiments, and you know exactly how they're going to prepare their system, how they're going to measure it, you know all of those details. And so the next morning you meet with your grad student, and your student gives you a notebook, and you have the notebook in your hand. Right before you open the notebook, you're in a position of self-locating uncertainty. You do not know which world you are in, and you won't know which world you're in until you open the book and read the results. And then that will tell you that you're in a world with such and such set of results. Okay, so before you open that book, you're uncertain as to which world you're in, and so there's a meaningful question that you can ask yourself. What is the probability that I'm in such and such a world? What is the probability that I'm in a world in which there were these results that were seen by my student? So that's the resolution of the incoherence problem. That's how probability becomes meaningful within this framework. So what about the quantitative problem? Remember, the quantitative problem was, let's say that you can find some probability measure within this framework. Why should that probability measure correspond to the Born rule? So in order to resolve that problem, the idea is to try to prove the Born-Weidman rule, which essentially means proving the Born rule for pre-observation descendants. Okay, so here's a proof. So what I want to do is I want to consider a measurement that is going to create several branches, and I want it to be the case that these branches are as qualitatively identical to each other as possible. Okay, I want them to be as similar to each other as possible. So here's an example. We've got a particle that's in a superposition of being located at A, B, and C, which I've just depicted there around planet Earth. And imagine we've got measuring devices in those locations, such that if the particle is found to be at A, then you are sent off by a rocket ship into room capital A up the top there. If the result is such that the particle is found in location B, then you're sent to room B. If the particle is found to be in location C, you're then sent to room C. You don't know what the result is, but nonetheless, this is what happens when the device measures the particle. Okay, and as you can see, I've tried to make it so that these branches are as qualitatively identical as possible. So we've got one branch, we can call it branch A, where room A is filled and there's nobody in B and C. And then we've got another branch, branch C, where room B is filled but A and C is empty, and same for branch C. So ideally, we'd want it to be the case that the branches are qualitatively identical except for the labels on the rooms, room A, room B, room C. Okay, imagine that this is the situation. Imagine you're the one that's been put into this situation and you're in this position of self-locating uncertainty. You don't know which room you're in. In other words, you don't know whether you are in world A, world B, or world C. But you do know what the quantum state is. There it is written down there. It's this symmetric quantum state. Now ask yourself, given that knowledge, what's the probability that you're in room A? That is, what's the probability that you're in world A? Now, I think it would be strange to say, well, with overwhelming probability, you're in world A. It's very improbable that you're going to be found in B and C. That doesn't seem like the right thing to say. And that's because of the symmetry of the situation. It seems the symmetry of the situation explains why you ought to ascribe being in world A with probability 1/3. Similarly for worlds B and C. But quantum theory tells us that the amplitude of each branch is the square root of 1/3. Well, the square of that is 1/3. And so it seems that we've proved the Born rule for this very specific scenario, this case of symmetric superpositions. Okay, that only gets us so far, but that's step one. So in step two, what we want to do is we want to try and prove the Born rule for any branch that has amplitude square root 1/3. And so just to start with step two, imagine that some external system comes along and does something to branch C, changes the internal state of branch C. Or imagine that B and C somehow combine. Or imagine that branch B splits into multiple branches, or branch C splits into multiple branches. If any of these situations happen, ask yourself, should you change the probability that you ascribe to being in world A? And we say no. And if we can establish that, then we get to the conclusion that the probability for being in any branch that has amplitude square root 1/3 is 1/3. And we can extend this to any branch with amplitude 1/n. It's not important that I picked three branches here. I could have picked multiple branches. Okay, so how is that argument going to work? So here I've just depicted the case where branch C is split into a couple of branches. And I'm wanting you to ask yourself, should that cause you to change the probability that you're ascribing to being in world A. And the idea is that you shouldn't, because of something to do with the ontology of the many worlds interpretation, to do with the fact that there's no non-local action at a distance in the many worlds interpretation. Okay, so why is there no non-local action at a distance? Well, the short answer to that is that in the standard arguments for why there's non-local action at a distance in quantum theory, those arguments presuppose that measurements have a single outcome. But that's denied by the many worlds interpretation. The long answer to the story can be found in a recent publication by Lev Weidman called From Bell Inequalities to the Many Worlds Interpretation. Now, if that's right, then what happens in B and C shouldn't affect what's happening in A. And so we conclude that whatever happens in those other branches, we retain that probability ascription to branch A. And in such situations, quantum mechanics tells us that the amplitude must stay the same as well, root 1 on 3. So then the idea is that we've proved the Born rule for any branch that has amplitude square root 1 on 3. Okay, so that's step 2. Step 3 now is where we want to try and prove the Born rule for any branch that has amplitude square root of m on n. And here we just appeal to consistency. So imagine that there is a branch that has amplitude square root m on n, and you're wondering, what is the probability that you're in that branch? Well, what you can do is you can just imagine splitting that branch into m branches, and that's going to get you several branches, m branches, each with amplitude square root 1 on n. We already know what the probability is to ascribe to those branches. That was from step 2. So the probability you ascribe to those branches is probability 1 on n. And so then one more principle is required, which is that the probability to find myself in one branch is the sum of the probability of descendant branches. And if that's right, then we can just work out what the probability of being in that original branch is. It's going to be m on n. Okay, so that's the proof. And if that works, then arguably we've removed at least what a lot of people take to be the primary barrier to accepting the many worlds interpretation. And I guess the other upshot would be what we have is an explanation of the origin of the Born rule in unadorned quantum theory. Okay, so now I want to change gears a little bit and go back to ontology. And I want to further clarify the ontology of the many worlds interpretation. So, first question, how do we think about the relationship between the wave function and worlds on this picture? I think if we're to properly understand how worlds relate to the wave function, we need to make this distinction between fundamental ontology and non-fundamental ontology. So by fundamental ontology, I mean the reality that's described by a complete physical theory. So this is the reality that's described in an absolutely precise, or as precise as we can get it, physical formalism. And so if we assume that quantum theory, unadorned quantum theory, is complete, then the ontology, the fundamental ontology of reality, is the wave function. What's non-fundamental ontology? This is a little bit more difficult to define, but here's a definition of non-fundamental ontology. Non-fundamental ontology is the reality described by true descriptions given in a vague language. Okay, so the language of tables and chairs and trees and people and minds and so on and so forth. Now, all of us believe, I take it, that there's any number of true descriptions given in a vague language. And so non-fundamental ontology is the reality that is described by these descriptions. Now, these descriptions are given by vague terminology. So part of what that means is that this terminology cannot be given absolutely precise definitions. So when we're trying to define a vague term, we can't give an absolutely precise definition. We can only give something vague or approximate, and there's a fair amount of leeway as to what counts as an adequate definition and what counts as an inadequate definition. Now, we take this to be a fairly adequate definition of a world. We can define a world as a unified, temporally extended totality of well-localized macroscopic objects. Now, again, for vague terminology, you can define your terms in ways that help you for certain purposes, provided that they roughly correspond to what we ordinarily take to be the meanings of these words. And the reason for defining the vague notion of a world in this way is that it helps us to resolve the measurement problem. So if we say, as advocates of the many worlds interpretation do, that reality is given by the wave function, part of the problem to do with the measurement problem is this problem of, well, where are we? If reality is fundamentally given by the wave function, where are we in that story? And it helps to answer that question by defining a world in this way and then decomposing the quantum state into what is sometimes called the decoherent bases, and then looking for branches of the wave function that correspond, at least roughly, to unified temporally extended totalities of well-localized macroscopic objects. And the idea is that we can do that, and when we do that, we find that our concept of a world is satisfied many times. Okay, so I think this definition of a world is helpful for resolving the measurement problem. 5 minutes? Okay, I'll try and speed up. And it gives us a starting ontology. This is the ontology of worlds. But really, when we're talking about the ontology of worlds, what we're talking about is a complete story, a story extended over time. And it seems we don't just want to talk about macroscopic objects when we're talking about worlds. We want to try and incorporate microscopic objects in our story of worlds as well. And in some cases, that's going to be easy enough, particularly if we're talking about particles that are continuously measured by the environment, particles in bubble chambers. We can tell a story about particles existing over time in worlds easily enough. But in a lot of cases, it's not going to be so easy. Remember, Bohr told us that we shouldn't be speaking about particles existing between measurements, for example. Okay, so let's consider an example, simple example to start with. We've got a measurement that creates two worlds, the A world, which is the world in which the detector A clicks, and the B world, which is the world in which detector B clicks. And so we can ask the question, from the perspective of a given world, let's choose world A, where was the particle? How can we answer that question, where was the particle? And there's a bunch of criteria that we could potentially give to try and answer this question. So we could say, well, the particle was in a superposition of being on both paths in world A. We could say that, but that doesn't seem so useful because the B path leaves no trace in the A world. So it doesn't seem like a good criteria for describing the history of the particle within the A world. Another option is to say that the particle was on the continuous trajectory where it could pass. That seems reasonable. An alternative option which gets you the same result is to say that the particle was where it left a weak trace, or the particle was where its backwards and forwards evolving wave functions overlap. And you might think, well, that's not as good as the previous option because it just gives us the same result, but it involves a lot more complications. But I think there are going to be several cases where the two-state vector formalism becomes essential to incorporating microscopic objects into our story of worlds. And in particular, I'm thinking of examples of discontinuous weak trace. So here's an example. Here's what an example of discontinuous weak trace would look like. Imagine that we've got an experiment where the experimental setup is such that the forwards evolving wave function looks like this, and the backwards evolving wave function looks like this. And so in this case, here are the two wave functions, and you can see that we've got non-continuous weak trace. So we've got this box in the middle where the two parts of the backwards evolving wave function, the forwards evolving wave function overlap, but the overall trace is discontinuous. So if you want to see real experiments where this has been realized, Lev's done an experiment like this recently. So how do we describe a case like that? Well, so recall our three options. The particle was wherever Schrodinger wave did not vanish. That was our first option from before. We already dismissed that. The second option, the particle was on the trajectory through which it could not pass. So we thought that was okay for the previous example, but that's not going to be so useful for this example because we don't have a continuous trajectory. At least we don't have a continuous trajectory where the particle could have a fix in the world. The weak trace is discontinuous. And so that leaves us with the third option, that the particle was where it left a weak trace. And that's going to allow us to incorporate microscopic particles, at least a more broader set of examples, into our story of worlds. And so that's a way that the two-state vector formalism can help us clarify the ontology of our worlds. So I think I'm almost out of time. So just to summarize, according to the many worlds interpretation, there's no measurement problem, so no need to change the quantum mechanical formalism to resolve it. At least what's considered by philosophers to be the major outstanding problem with the many worlds interpretation can arguably be resolved within the self-locating uncertainty account. And finally, the two-state vector formalism is useful for clarifying worlds, the ontology of worlds in this framework. Thank you.
Questions? I think you gave a very nice presentation. What's always bothered me about this is since it's many worlds, one ought to be able to define a world in a precise way. Now, if people can be satisfied with less precision or more precision, I go in the direction of more precision. And it seems that your definition depended upon a macroscopic object and what is meant by a macroscopic superposition. If I give you a state vector for, let's say, the local galactic cluster, and give you as much time and computing capacity as you wish, can you select out for me the world? So can you tell me what the macroscopic objects, how you're going to define them, what separation is it going to have to be so that it is a macroscopic superposition as opposed to the object in an uncertain kind of state? Is there a set of rules for this kind of thing?
No, okay. I don't want it to be the case that worlds are well-defined, and I don't think we should be demanding that. And that's an important point, I think. Why is that? Well, look, so the many worlds, advocates of the many worlds interpretation say that the complete story of physics is given by the wave function in the Schrodinger equation. Now, someone comes along and poses an objection to this, which is the measurement problem. But this objection is being posed in vague language. The objection is of the form, where's my measuring devices? Where am I? Where are the macroscopic entities? Because the objection is being posed in terms of a vague terminology, I think the correct response is to respond in terms of vague terminology. The response says, okay, you're having trouble finding how your macroscopic concepts apply, given that the fundamental ontology is given by the wave function. Well, here I can give you a rough definition of a concept of a world, and then I can decompose the quantum state in the decoherent basis and show you that your macroscopic concept of a world roughly applies like this. And that's meant to answer the question. So the concept of worlds only come into this theory to answer objections that are already stated in vague terminology. If those objections don't arise in the first place, we don't need to talk about worlds at all. We just need to talk about the wave function in the Schrodinger equation.
John? As far as I understand the way you're defining many worlds, you're describing it as what would be called a Markov branching process, or just a branching process. Now, it was shown back in the 70s that the Schrodinger equation cannot evolve as a Markov process in probabilistic terms. It's a non-Markov process. So I got my question is if you're saying your evolution is a Markov process, and yet you're matching the predictions of the Schrodinger equation, which is a non-Markov process, what are you actually doing there? Because, you know, quantum mechanics evolved not in a non-Markov way, whether you're talking about the Schrodinger equation. I haven't seen a proof of it, but I'm pretty sure in the Heisenberg picture, the exact same thing has to hold. So that's what I see as I forget about the philosophers, there's a fundamental mathematical question, but I don't understand how you're modeling it in terms of what we understand about the probability of evolution.
So the idea is that all closed physical systems evolve in accordance with the Schrodinger equation, and it sounds like what you're saying is that's actually problematic. So the physical assumption is problematic. And you said that, is it?
No, I didn't say problematic. I said evolves in a according to a random process that's non-Markov, and branching processes evolve be a Markov process, and so there's two different probabilistic descriptions that are incompatible with each other. That's what I'm saying. And the original was a proof of this was back in the 70s by a guy named Gillespie, and there have been papers since then in Physical Review trying to quantify exactly what the aspects of the difference between a Markov and non-Markov evolution are in the random process for quantum mechanics.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm not familiar with that objection, so perhaps I'll look into that further.
No one else is. I've never read it before. I was just wondering.
I mean, I think it's just that in the limits of decoherence, it does become a Markov process, but you don't have to go to that limit and you can still get sort of recoherence. So in that case, it's a very, very different Markov process.
During your talk, I was thinking about the many alternative branches that your talk itself could have taken. So there's one world in which you have just argued the opposite of what you have argued in this world. So how can you assign any truth value to what you have been saying in this world?
I don't see any reason to believe that there are worlds such like that. So there are arguments out there. For example, Henry Stapp has tried to criticize the many worlds interpretation by saying that every time we deliberate between doing action A and doing action B, we create a world in which we do A and in which we do B. But I think the arguments for those conclusions are rather inconclusive. I would have to see a proof for why that is the case, for why there's actually that many worlds according to the many worlds interpretation. You could take a very extreme position on this and say, well, branching didn't really start occurring in much detail until human beings started magnifying the microscopic properties of particles up into the macroscopic level. I think there would be a bit of a problem if there were that many worlds and branching was happening that constantly, but I'm not sure that they are happening. Branching is happening that constantly.
I observed and measured what you were saying.
All right, let's stop here. Let's thank all of them again.